Welcome back to another episode of Not Gods and Machines, a podcast brought to you by the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa through the auspices of the Writing and Humanities Program. My name's Jason T. Lewis. I'm the director of the Writing and Humanities Program, and today I have with me Kelsey Adler.
Hi. Yes.
Mark Terrell. Yeah. Adam Irwood.
Hello.
And of course, Casey McClear.
I thought he was pointing at me when he said Kelsey.
I'm still not convinced you weren't.
But I still said the right thing.
Yeah.
I think you almost called me Kelsey and you just lucked out that there's also a Kelsey in the room.
No. I had the names in my head. I was ready to go.
Okay.
So what is this podcast all about? Let me tell you, folks, what this is all about. So here at the Writing and Humanities Program, the Carver College of Medicine, we try and bring a little bit of the feely side of life into the sciencey sides of medicine. And so we look for ways to bring the arts, humanities, humanism into the daily lives of our students, and that's one thing that we try and do with this podcast, because doctors, as you know, are not gods, nor are they machines. They are people thinking, feeling, breathing, who have to be, in many ways, strong and resilient. And so hopefully with these kinds of discussions, we can build those strengths. So today what we're going to talk about is something a little bit different than we did in last episode. Last episode, if you didn't check it out, we talked about Raymond Carver's A Small Good Thing, a fantastic short story. And today we're going to talk about two pieces. One is from the Journal of the American Medical Association. They have a series toward the back of their journal every time it's published called A Piece of My Mind. I always want to say in my own words, it's really a piece of my mind. And they select different pieces by physicians for each copy. What am I saying? They select different pieces for each issue. And this issue, we've got Joseph Bell from the Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts. This piece is entitled Osler in Jail. So William Osler was sort of I don't know if you would call him the father of humanistic medicine, but he was a huge influencer in humanism in medicine. And so this physician writes about his practice in jail. He's not in jail. But the patients he's working with are incarcerated patients.
Wait, if you went to jail, could you keep practicing medicine in jail, or would you lose your license automatically?
They'd chase you with a broom when you started doing it.
I think you might be somehow, whether it's losing your license or not, you might be somehow barred from the practice of medicine.
Forever or just for a little bit?
Maybe it's a good question.
Friend wants to know.
One of the more famous physicians who was put in jail was Jeffrey McDonald, who was convicted of killing his family. But that's a whole other story.
I'm okay with him losing his license, actually.
I don't think he kept practicing.
That's probably fine.
No, it's an interesting story. Maybe one of these days we'll cover that in an episode. But so Osler in Jail is about this physician's thoughts on practicing medicine with incarcerated patients. Early in the article, he says, quoting Osler, "A good physician treats the disease. The great physician treats the patient who has the disease." So what do you guys think about that idea? I mean, we'll unpack that at this point, and then maybe we definitely will start to unpack the idea that how that works with incarcerated people. So once again, that quote is, "The good physician treats the disease. The great physician treats the patient who has the disease."
I mean, I'm pretty sure it's painted on one of the Communities.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say it, but it totally is.
Yeah,
quote is up there. So I think it's something that a lot of medical students resonate with.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest thing I've seemed to notice is the disconnect as people start to move more toward the reality of clinic and how is great as it would be to treat the patient, sometimes it does start to feel more mechanical and like you're just treating the symptoms.
Huh.
But I think that within, I mean, I don't know. Do you guys like that quote? I think that a lot of medical students I've talked to, it's resonated with.
Well, go ahead, Casey.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, I think sort of along the lines of losing some of that, thinking of your patients as you're treating the whole patient. A lot of that's just because our schedules just don't allow time for it. You can't know everything about a patient, treat everything about a patient in 15 minutes. Like, it's just impossible. And so, yeah, I feel like a lot of people forget that out of necessity more than out of because they don't actually care.
Right, right. That's a good point. Yeah.
And I think there are probably two things that go into it. There's the idea of what they call the hidden curriculum, right, where the sort of theoretical realities of something like that Osler quote they resonate with people. And of course, everyone goes into medicine in order to help people. But the hidden curriculum introduces ideas of bureaucracy and all these different kinds of things into that more esoteric thought process. But I think it also has something to do with how people are or are not resilient in the face of potential burnout. I think that there's a lot of difficulty if you see a patient every 15 minutes for 8 hours a day, and the level that they could be struggling with in their own lives for health and mental health, anything. It's really difficult to find that balance of being present and able to empathize, and falling into that that more machine like cog in the machine widget assembly line dongle. Kind of idea, right?
Dongle.
Yeah, dongle, yes. it's my favorite word.
I'm sorry, it's just such like a great it. Word.
No. I'm actually going to have a t-shirt made with the word so for my YouTube channel because I linger over that word.
Oh, really?
On my YouTube channel a lot. Dongle. So anyway, but so we've established this baseline that, yes, in a perfect world, you want to be serving the patient. You want to be treating the patient that has the disease as opposed to just maybe mechanically delivering the care that's necessary for the disease. But how does it become complicated if you are practicing in a place like a jail? Or does it?
I think actually, if you guys don't mind, it might help to define exactly what it means to treat the patient or the person.
Sure.
Because it seems like there's a lot of ambiguity around it. No one's really defined it concretely. Mm. And if you're going to have a productive conversation, we might want to make sure we're all speaking the same language about the same thing.
Sure.
Okay. So, I mean, what do you guys think that means to treat a person exactly?
I think it's like to see them as a whole person, sort of. And maybe not doesn't necessarily mean to know everything about them, but to get a feel for who they are and what their life is like, and then in the way that you treat them, make it compatible with who they are as a person, as opposed to just like dispensing medications, maybe taking a little extra time to explain them, or choosing a medication that you take once a day instead of three times a day because you know they can't take it that much, or making sure you choose a medication that is not going to be too expensive because they'll just leave and not get it. And, like, not buy the medication.
That's a great point, though, because, I mean...
No, it's true.
It's hard to actually define it specifically, right?
Like, yeah.
Because you could go all the way and become a stalker or... I mean, but...
Look them up on Facebook.
No one expects, a healer or physician to know everything about someone, kind of like you're saying. But then, right, where is the line? And I guess it's just that... If you ask me, at least, I would think that... When you're still effectively treating your patients, but even more so because you're tailoring it in a sense to, I guess realistic parts of their life and their personality. Yeah. But it really is actually hard to define that.
Well, and that to me, a lot of times people talk about the desire to quote unquote go back to the old days where there was continuity of care in terms of the physician cares for you from birth to death. Mm-hmm. And certainly that still can happen and does happen, but it's placed in stark contrast to the more sort of bureaucratic corporate idea of medicine as well.
No more house calls.
No more house calls. Yeah.
I wish we still did house calls. I think telemedicine is going to be sort of the new fangled house call. Just for the record. Because it's very good for people with disabilities or no transportation.
That's true. That's true. Then you just have to make sure that people can effectively utilize the technology. I actually just heard...
they'll just drone you in.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's like Amazon.
New house calls, just the door. Fly my drone around town.
So. Yeah, it's like either Amazon develops drones that can pick people up and take them.
Got another one.
Or you just have a
jetpack before that. Yeah.
The waiting room is just a bunch of people hovering over your office. Yeah. They just like terrifying. The roof opens up and they just them in.
Yeah. It sounds like you're in one of those terrible machines. Yeah. Or stuffed animals.
Or potentially more frightening, like you as the physician just sit in front of a screen and the drone goes out. With your face on a screen.
That's what I was thinking.
It'll be like in Fallout.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be like in Fallout. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Let's not go
very
into.
Very off topic.
Okay, let's
sorry.
Not go that
I'm
far.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So this physician goes on to say, I go to jail every Thursday evening to see inmate patients in a student-run clinic. Osler, an early champion of pulling medical students out of the lecture hall and onto the wards to learn medicine from real patients, would have loved it. He goes on to say a little bit later on, an acquaintance once asked me, why would you want to treat criminals? This statement, you know, he says, well, most people there are awaiting trial and presumed innocent, so really the correct term is detainees.
But.
But that's.
Irrelevant.
Yeah.
That's a hedge at best, right? Yeah. It's like, well, they're not prisoners. They're not criminals. They're, you know, innocent until proven guilty.
I wouldn't treat a real criminal.
Yeah. So that's the whole idea. I feel more attuned to the extra glow and warmth that we radiate to the patients we judge to be righteous or adherent or perhaps just more like ourselves. This is where the real sort of like soul-searching philosophical aspect of patient care comes into play, right? This whole idea that there are multiple strata that we use to differentiate ourselves from our fellow human beings, right? And the question that's being begged here is, as a physician, what role or responsibility do you have in treating someone who has been placed into something like the strata of a criminal, someone who has wronged society and then occupies that space in our social strata, you know, where someone would be prompted to ask a question like, well, why would you want to treat criminals? What does that question beg for an answer?
I mean, it just implies that we think of criminals as subhuman, that as soon as you've done anything, even a small thing, to violate the social code or social norms, however sort of ethically valid that law even is, and that's a whole other subject we could get into, but you know, regardless, anyone that violates that and gets caught is seen by a lot of people as sort of subhuman. And I don't know, I take a lot of issue with that conceptualization.
Or it says something about how we view healthcare, is if it's a human right or not.
Right.
That's very true.
That yeah.
Or a privilege. Mm. That's very true too.
And that's another sort of, especially in the United States, we have to recognize that we have a constitution that says, well, all men are created equal. So we can extrapolate that to meaning all people, but yeah.
I'm a constitutional originalist. I think we have to take it literally.
Okay. Okay. That's not the position I thought you would have taken, Casey.
I don't know what would ever make you think that.
But, you know, there is an innate hypocrisy in some of the ways that we speak about ourselves as a nation and a collection of people governed by the same rules and laws, mm-hmm. and how we act those rules and laws out, mm-hmm. right? So, I guess what we have to now ask is: do we consider healthcare a right or a privilege?
Is anyone in this room going to say it's a privilege?
No.
Yeah, that's what I
thought. No. I won't. But there may be people in the audience who we can challenge to defend. I mean, you know, they don't have to defend it. If you want to send us an email or something.
Can they call in?
Well, we're not live.
Oh. But well, not right now.
Like,
no, I guess we can't
talk
about it next
time. Yeah, you can send us an email or comment on the podcast itself to let us know if you think, but I think most people would at least believe that they think that healthcare is a right.
Here's the deal though. While I agree that it should be a right, with what we have now, you are privileged to have healthcare.
Yeah.
You know, it should be a right, but not everyone does have that access. So I think it exists as a privilege, but it should in its essence be a right. So I think it's important to make that distinction because otherwise we get kind of into this weird space of just pretending that the world as it is however we say it should be, and that's just not the case.
Yes, and I think that is actually very relevant in, I think my impression of the healthcare is a privilege, like it sounds kind of asinine, but I think the idea is that healthcare is a limited resource and that if you cannot give it to everyone, then you have to make tough decisions about how it's going to be distributed. I personally don't think healthcare needs to be as limited as it is. I think we've created some semi-artificial constraints on it that have caused some of the problems. But, like, you know, just to give the people a break who do sort of see it as a privilege, like, I think that's where a lot of them are coming from.
Yeah, but that still begs the same question.
Sure.
I mean, do you put healthcare behind a paywall? Right, that's sort of the question. Like, well, you know, you can go to the free clinic if you don't have the means to have insurance to cover healthcare, but the real healthcare is maybe behind a paywall, and so
exactly
that stratification is based solely on economics,
yeah,
and not need,
mm-hmm.
And that's the crazy thing,
and not human suffering at all.
No.
Like,
no.
I would like to see people who don't think poor people deserve health care to come in and say that to some of my patients' faces. Like,
I've heard people say that, and I've heard them make the argument, and I know that I believe that they hold those beliefs.
Yeah.
They have worked hard to put themselves in the position to be able to do what's necessary to protect the health and well-being of them and their families.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, in my position as host of this show and whatever, I try and make sure that I understand empathetically people's viewpoints. I don't have to agree with them.
Yeah.
But I try and put myself in the position to have empathy toward those viewpoints. And hopefully, eventually, we come to a place where we can have these discussions and vent these arguments in a way that doesn't challenge, you know, like the primal instincts of the other person.
Of name calling,
right.
On
they
Twitter.
They all degraded to ad hominem attacks.
Yeah. It's such a shame, though,
right.
Because you lose so many opportunities to gather these new ideas and really talk about them.
I know.
The idea is to talk about the ideas, not the other person who happens mm-hmm. to hold them. It's really a shame.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, for me, unless we take economics out of the equation and we say something like healthcare is going to be provided and it's going to be completely subsidized by the state, mm-hmm. And healthcare providers will be provided a basic income commensurate with the service they provide, and we take the economics out of it entirely, I think there will always be a stratification.
Mm-hmm.
What happens a lot of times is we live in a representative democracy here in the United States. And that idea is that we are all free to live out our lives and pursue our goals, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, well, what's happened in the last 100 plus years is that there's been this idea that democracy and capitalism are the same thing.
Yeah, I think a lot of that came probably with like the Red Scare post-World War II and stuff, do you think?
Well, no, that's just when it was
away from communism.
That was just when it was injected into the system. Mm,
okay.
But really it comes from earlier in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when people started to really accrue wealth.
Mm.
And wealth then started to mean upward mobility. And that's when you started to redefine the American dream away from manifest destiny, you know, go out and make your way and find your best version of yourself,
mm-hmm.
and started to equate it with your financial the financial situation that you're in. So post-World War II, it became part of the entire system in that instead of manifest destiny, it became this idea that you live the American dream if you can buy the things that equal the American dream. You know,
yeah.
House with white picket fence, 2-car garage, television in every room, all these things became equals of.
Yeah.
And so then we moved away from personal fulfillment to bank account fulfillment as a way to judge our success.
Yeah. So this may seem a little off topic for the story, but I think it's actually relevant because, I mean, a lot of people think of very poor people or people in prison as not deserving it for the same reason. And that's, you know, you don't deserve it because of some sort of behavior
right.
that you've performed. And then also I think just acknowledging that there's most of the people in jail are poor.
Yeah.
They were poor before they came in, and that sort of led them there, or now they can't get a job because they have a felony, and now they're poor.
Yeah.
Because they've been in jail.
And the majority of the poor people that are in jail are also people that have been traditionally
disenfranchised.
Disenfranchised, yes. Thank you for that word. The interesting thing about it, though, and I think the reason, not to turn this into sort of a rant about...
Uh-oh.
About, you know, we're
already in it. Don't worry. We've been in it for several minutes now.
The truth or lies of how our democracy actually operates.
Mm-hmm.
And turn it back to the practice of medicine in both its best case scenario and in its sort of hidden curriculum, the way it's actually practiced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we started talking about all this stuff because we were thinking about someone like a prisoner in a situation where they have very little control over their situation. Maybe it's because they have broken the rules of our society and are therefore being punished for those transgressions. But does that make them more or less worthy of or deserving of the basics of, you know,
Is not having good access to healthcare a reasonable punishment for committing a crime?
I think that's ridiculous. I agree.
But that is kind of what it ends up boiling down to. If someone's
does
like,
it,
why would though? You want to treat criminals? Like, implies that no one should treat criminals. And that means if you're a criminal, not getting healthcare is just going to be part of that.
Right.
So whether they would say it in those terms doesn't really matter because practically speaking, that's what happens.
It's interesting though, because
is it?
Well,
no, it's boring. Everybody leave.
No, I mean,
is that practically what happens though?
I think you could make the argument that people in that situation might not receive the same access to healthcare. As opposed to someone who has not broken the rules of our society.
It's not that they don't ever get any health care ever, but it is definitely known to be of a lower quality.
Yeah. It's interesting that we would have this argument about health care when the justice system has solved this problem long ago, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts. Like, you get representation. You know, it's part of the law of the land. You get a lawyer whether you can afford it or not. And yet, that we have this conversation about healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I guess healthcare doesn't have a lot to do with justice in the, you know, right or, you know, did it or didn't do it mm-hmm. aspect. But still, that you would give one person the basic right of fair representation under the law and deny that same person potentially access to their continuing their life with or without healthcare. One of the things in the discussion that we had the other day about this in a class setting, one student asked about someone like Charles Manson, mm-hmm. who's experiencing some serious health issues right now, and he's in his 70s, and so he's incarcerated for life, mm-hmm. multiple mm-hmm. life sentences, right? And so this student, you know, whether he was playing devil's advocate or it was, you know, a question that came from his heart, and really he wanted to know the answer, he said, well, why should we expend resources on someone like Charles Manson? What do you guys think?
I think it's cruel to not do so. Like, I don't know, if we're not going to, like, death penalty him,
right.
I mean, then why would you just lock him up and deprive him? Like, that's awful. Essentially, that's even worse. Yeah.
See, this is where it gets interesting.
And I'm not, like, super pro-death penalty for the record, but I'm just saying, like...
Well, this is where we start to get biblical, right?
Uh-oh.
Because the death penalty, the rationale that lots of people use for the death penalty is this eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth mm-hmm. kind of thing. That is very much taken...
Which always ends very well.
Yeah. But... I made the argument in that case that since Charles Manson was tried by the law of our land and in the state of California, the death penalty was not on the table. Actually, it was on the table, and then the Supreme Court took it away, but that we don't need to get into the logistics of it. Because he was not able to have the death penalty enforced upon him, do we then not have a duty to serve his needs while asking him to live out the penalty that we've imposed upon him?
I think of course we do. And I honestly think it's sort of overstepping our responsibility and our what we've been trained and educated to do to even ask this question, if it makes sense.
Yeah.
We have this entire system put in place filled with people who have gone to school and have trained for years to do this kind of thing, and they have done their job and they've given their judgment, and that judgment is that life sentence, which is horrible enough on its own. It doesn't include no access to health care, and I don't think that that's our thing to add or our decision to make.
No, yeah. What do you guys think? Yeah.
It's interesting because just the fact that they're in prison is already probably going to be adverse to their health. I mean, just being separated from loved ones or family will have some emotional or mental consequences. So it's kind of like, how do you limit the adverse effects on the health of the individual of the sentence? You know, how far are you going to go towards providing healthcare for the individual? You know, and where are you going to draw the line?
I think aside from elective procedures, everything that any other person would receive should be available. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think we need to remember that criminals are humans, and even, first of all, I mean, most of them aren't Charles Manson. Even people who have murdered people, most of them aren't, like, as bad, you know, as people
would
think of
them as being. Well, here's the thing about the whole bad, though.
But even so, they're humans, and, like, I don't know. I just feel like as doctors, we should not, our job's not to judge people.
Well, part of the question, too, becomes, is the job of the penal system to punish or rehabilitate?
Oh, it's totally to punish.
Right. And it varies state, also, and it varies state by state.
Another thing too.
Yeah.
When people are dangerous to others.
Yeah. And it varies from state to state whether they consider themselves a rehabilitation or a punishment system. But the thing is, and this is a question that's posed in the reading as well. Is there a sliding scale? Like, okay, so Charles Manson actually, little known, well, it's a well-known fact, but Charles Manson didn't actually kill anyone.
He convinced other people to kill people?
He convinced other people to kill for him.
Right. For the record, I didn't know that he didn't kill anybody.
Neither did I.
Little known. With the cases of the Tate-LaBianca murders, where I believe it was like six people died.
Yeah.
He was not physically present at any of those murders. So it was like his cult of personality. Basically, they had to prove that he was responsible because of his control over other people. Okay, aside, over. but, you know, we can argue evil or worse or better crimes or any of those things. But to me, the question comes down to, and this goes beyond incarcerated people and into these other realms that we've discussed, like what ultimately, and this isn't necessarily a question for you folks in the room, but for everyone, what ultimately is the job of the physician? Coming back to Osler's idea of you don't just treat the disease, you have to treat the patient. And how would Osler react or sort of think about that question in the context of incarcerated people?
So I'll just use my metaphor that I've described doctors as we aren't necessarily always. In fact, I know a lot of doctors are pretty judgmental behind closed doors, but I feel like we should approach it as we are the watchers on the wall. We take no side. For all you Game of Thrones people out there.
Mm-hmm.
They have a side.
But,
they take a side.
That's fine. That's part of the metaphor. People are bad at not taking sides.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's not dramatic if they don't take a side.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? Like in theory.
Right. Right. I like to call it the Peter Parker conundrum. Right?
Let's hear it. Yeah.
Who is Peter Parker? Is that what you're asking?
Well, Peter Parker, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know, with great power comes great responsibility, right?
Yeah.
So within the context of our society, physicians have a huge amount of power, right? Hard-earned mastery of the arcane art of medicine, right? So people trust physicians. People go to physicians as objectively, knowers of things that will that will change people's lives, right?
Sounding more and more like a wizard.
Well, I mean, in the days
that's going on my business card.
In the days before medicine, and one point that's made in this article is that Osler was talking this humanism game when trying to gain credibility for medicine over the charlatans. The barbers of the time, right? He was trying to transition people into a position of trust for the medical field. And so now that trust is being challenged in this case by how you work with people who you can subjectively judge.
And I think we need to remember too that there's people in jail who are more good than bad. And there's people not in jail who are probably more bad than good.
I think that's the thing that I get confused about.
So you don't need to, it doesn't help anything to judge anyone. Yeah.
The whole good versus bad thing, I also don't think is necessarily for us to decide.
Yeah.
And there is a very strong pattern and tendency for people to see someone who has done something bad and because of that immediately condemn the entire person in the individual crazy little universe that they are in themselves as bad. And that is just such a shame, I think, and such an overstatement or understatement. I don't know. It doesn't quite apply, I think, when you really consider all that is a person.
Yes.
So when we get to saying that someone is good, someone is bad, someone is deserving, someone is not, it's more of, in terms of something as important as healthcare and continuing life, and giving those life-sustaining treatments, it's to allow to exist this conscious living thing.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's good or bad, which I think are terms that are effectively useless and mostly made up, to be honest. I mean, can we really say that good and bad exist objectively at all?
I like you.
Thanks, but it just gets into a mess. And that's like underlying all of this, which makes all these surface questions even more confusing for me to even think about.
Well, and that's the thing too. I mean, even if we just decide to define good and bad as the collection of laws that we as a society have agreed upon, mm-hmm. and the commensurate punishment, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. even if we just stay there and yeah, I think for me, and I would hope as a non-physician, that regardless of what side of that line I exist on, I can trust, as Osler would want me to be able to trust, a physician to deliver the care that I need because of my personhood.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Kelsey, that's kind of what I hear you saying.
Yes, exactly. I would hope that the physician would be able to get through this problem by abandoning this whole binary good, bad thinking, judgment thing, and just recognize personhood and have that be enough, you know?
Yeah. Right. And I mean, that's kind of the point he ultimately ends up making, is that by working in these prisons, it's allowed them to kind of see it as a spectrum, kind of like you're saying, whereas we see these bias and we have all of these. I mean, he gives examples of patients people don't like to treat. And then the other story we're going to talk about is similar. But yeah. He's saying here's what society collectively, for better or worse, tends to think of as the bad, even though, like you're saying, it's not it's not justified, and it's not our place to define that. It is a way that people see the world regardless.
Right. And I think the argument that people would make back at that, and it goes back to kind of what we've been talking about, is that as a scarce resource, mm-hmm. whether artificially so or not, if there are people who aren't, and this is a totally different discussion for a totally different podcast, but if there are people who are quote unquote following the rules and yet still not having access to care, how do we justify caring for those who have gone afoul of our society? And I don't know that there's an answer to that question that we can, there's not a pat sort of like, well, it's because of, you know, what, there's not an answer that we can give. Mm-hmm. But I think Mark makes a good point. This is a good place to transition into article number two, which complicates this in a much more personal way. Like we've been talking about this in a sort of high-minded, subjective way with this. You know, there aren't necessarily individual people that we are talking about in this sort of intellectual conversation mm-hmm. about caring for incarcerated people. But Article 2 makes it very personal. This is an article written for the Annals of Internal Medicine section on being a doctor. This was published, when was this published? 2016. And Bernard L. Sussman, MD, is the writer. So out there in podcast land, you can find this in that issue, and I'm sure available online in various different ways. And we'll try.
Podcast land.
Yeah. And, you know. And we'll try and find ways to provide access to these so you can read them as well. My hope is that we can sort of post things a week in advance so that our listeners could potentially prep themselves for what we're going to talk about. But it's early days.
Book club.
That's kind of what I'm hoping it's going to be.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is entitled The Nazi Patient. And
it had to be a Nazi.
Well, you know, the times demand the proper comparisons. Yeah. I'm not naming any names, but, you know, this is here in Iowa right now. There's a legislation out there in the state of Iowa that is potentially going to ask people to declare their political party.
What?
Yeah.
It's bad here, y'all.
Yeah.
It won't go.
So in universities and other public education institutions, new hires, potentially, if this were to pass, would have to declare their affiliation, their party affiliation, so that there could then be a balance imposed.
What are they going to do if I don't?
There's too many Democrats in these here colleges. Like,
yeah, the liberal thinkers are just, you know, messing with the minds of potential followers of the whatever. Right?
It's funny because people on the other side say the both sides say the same thing once you get extreme enough.
Well, yeah. I mean,
it's true.
It almost makes you yearn for the days when you were just picking from, you know, like one sort of ineffectual bureaucrat or another.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, but now it's the Wild West. We're the Wild Midwest, I guess.
It's almost like there's a whole spectrum of political views and opinions and only two parties to represent them.
Yeah, with artificial differences imposed.
I'm sure it'll be fine.
We'll be happy.
It'll be fine.
Yeah, but okay. Political rant number two.
Any potentially more controversial bases we can touch here? Nazis. Yeah.
Oh,
so,
Nazis.
So let's get on to talking about this. So the background here is that Dr. Sussman is an internal medicine doc. He gets a new patient, an elderly man, identified here only as Mr. W. And Mr. W is moving from one physician to Dr. Sussman. And he came in, he was delivering gifts to everybody, he was being very magnanimous and all that. But Dr. Sussman says, other subjects made me more ill at ease. Mr. W wanted me to know how happy he was to have a Jewish doctor. He cataloged the Jewish physicians and dentists he'd known through the years, including his former primary care physician. These relationships had been uniformly wonderful. He got along so well with the Jewish doctors that he was delighted, and he was delighted to count me in their ranks. I felt uncomfortable being assessed this way.
She's about to feel more uncomfortable.
Yeah. So,
I was wondering the whole time. I wanted to ask the guy, like, why? And it never really makes it clear. And I mean, to an extent, it's beside the point. But I was still very curious why he insists on going to all these Jewish doctors.
I asked the same question before the show.
Yeah. I just
really
strange.
And we don't know.
We don't know for sure. I mean,
what's this you guys are talking about?
I think there's the potential for long-standing stereotypes to be at play here, but I can't know that. Different generations had different feelings about different things, and they became prevalent. Mm-hmm. So,
like, you can still be an anti-Semite and think that like Jewish people are good bankers or something. Like, it may still be like that kind of like weird.
Right. And that's kind of what I felt like was subtextual here, but
that's kind of what I'd guess.
It wasn't addressed there, but the tension is clear almost from the beginning. And I think initially Dr. Sussman's tension was all about the way that this patient was introducing himself and potentially trying to ingratiate himself with the people who worked in the office and the doctor himself.
I mean, ultimately, it was very suspicious.
Yeah. It's like, okay, what are you hiding? Like, what are you overcompensating for?
Right.
Yeah, and it's hard to know, like, having read the article now and knowing how it turns out, you go back and look on that and say, oh, I see breadcrumbs, but were they really there before? It's hard to say. It's interesting because here we had the opportunity to talk about sort of the separation between physician and patient and that relationship. Mm-hmm. But we also have very human situations. So we have a Jewish physician whose parents fought for the U.S. in the Second World War. And later we find out that Mr. W. was in fact a soldier on the opposite side. So here's another quote.
Even more than that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
There's personal guard.
I'm enthusiastic.
I'm getting there. No. I'm getting there. So here's a
spoilers.
Quote.
Sorry.
No spoilers.
Well, we're going to link the article. Yeah.
I have to hedge because I don't know what's legal, okay? I want to be legal.
He's just going to start reading them word for word.
Yeah.
Change words here and there.
I know what, you know, fair use is with clips of music or video, but this is...
Well, then sing it.
So Mr. W answered in a reserved, frosty tone. His face tightened. He spoke bitterly of the poverty and hardship of his childhood years immediately after World War II. Work and food were in limited supply. He joined a Nazi youth group with enthusiasm. When I pressed further, he explained without apology that Hitler had inspired him. Later, he was recruited to the SS. In fact, he served in Hitler's personal honor guard, traveling with him throughout Germany and I'm not good with German, in the Bavarian Alps.
Yeah.
yeah.
Someone died in the Alps.
Perfect English.
Yeah. So he went on to
Berchtesgaden?
Yes, Berchtesgaden. Yes, I think that's right.
Sure.
I have no idea.
Berchtesgaden.
Ah, yes, Berchtesgaden.
Mein Lieblingsfarbe.
You know, for all the world to listen to, we are doing our best to not butcher German pronunciation.
I like bad English a lot, so you can make fun of our bad German. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fine.
You can call her Kelsey.
Just don't call me Kelsey.
So now let's put ourselves in the position of Dr. Sussman. This is where, like, the rubber meets the road in terms of, like, personal versus professional feelings or considerations. Putting ourselves in that position, what are you guys thinking?
Without spoiling?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Let's unpack this thing by piece.
Yeah.
Okay. First encounter when you find out he's a Nazi, how do you feel? You're Jewish.
I am Jewish, actually.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay, so
how do you feel?
Should I call myself? I don't know. I'm not religious, but...
Well, still, I don't think you had to be.
I don't feel anything, to be honest, but I'm reading this article and I'm not in person.
Yeah, you also didn't grow up during the war.
Right. If I were in person, I can't promise that I wouldn't feel anything, but I like to think that I would not be affected to the best of my ability. So.
Right. And that sort of goes back to a little bit of what we were talking about with the previous article of, like, doing, you know, doing your professional duty, acting out that Peter Parker conundrum in the best possible way. That idea that, like, I am in a position where the dynamic is different. He needs my help. I can either choose to give it to him without qualification, or I can let my personal feelings come into this.
Well, the thing is, too, with the whole personal feelings thing is when I do have them, in considering certain situations that we've had, like in medical ethics class and stuff, it's a lot easier to take care of them by just running to previous thought patterns that I've trusted before to dispel these sorts of issues. So in this sort of case, I would imagine what any other person on the planet might have ended up like if he were to be put in the exact position as Mr. W. And in that sense, I'm sort of absolving Mr. W as a person and living being from responsibility of doing what he did, because ultimately we are so strongly influenced by our environment and what we're exposed to. And in a lot of ways, we have very little control over that. So it's kind of a nature versus nurture analogy.
Right.
For virtue ethics versus...
Well, it's a free will. It's a question of free will and determinism.
Pretty much, yeah. So that kind of gets rid of the problem for me. I could easily be angry if I were to just be very quick about it and just go to intuitive thought and feeling and gut. But if you really think about it, like analytically, you can't really blame a dog for eating some dog food. It was there. He was trained to do this, you know, and any other dog would respond the same way to the same conditions.
Humans are on some level above dogs.
Yeah. Are we though? Are we?
Well, I think
in some way we are.
Either way, but I think that as a civilization, we certainly collectively believe that. Yeah.
Yeah, we certainly are different, and I don't know how to express it, but we're more capable, and we can think.
Even analyzing this.
Yeah.
That's the big thing.
Yeah. We are more capable in certain areas, but not all. And I think it's important to still recognize our beast-like tendencies
that we can't escape from. Yeah, I mean, it ties exactly into what you're saying about how you hate using terms good and bad, when a lot of what might make us good or bad is a product of our experiences and like situation. And then outside of that, a lot of it's our genetics. start to lose free, again, the argument of free will. And I think that it's another philosophical tangent we can go on.
Yeah. He's just like a little computer that has basically been programmed. And can I be mad at that? I don't know.
Yeah. And even if you can't convince most of the audience that free will is a myth and we are all locked into our own brain patterns, I think it can still be consistent to say that probability of things is affected. The probability that you're going to become a Nazi if you're put in this situation with these other factors, like, is much higher for someone like this guy, you know.
If only we had twin studies for this kind of...
twin studies.
So unethical.
Well, the interesting thing here is the way that Mr. W describes his... The pattern or the way his life played out, I mean, post-World War I, Germany was left pretty destitute, and there were a lot of people with a lot of need. And one of the things that was attractive about Hitler was his nationalist, populist viewpoint and the way that he tried to bring back the idea of German pride. Okay, now and that's trying to look at the phenomenon of Hitler through a lens that isn't colored by
what's happening right now.
Well, it's impossible for me to look at it without that. But just trying to understand through Mr. W's eyes in an empathetic way what those events and the things that were happening and his ability to sort of get into a situation where perhaps he could do better for his family and for himself. I mean, so the way it's described here...
Evil people rarely think they're evil.
Right.
I think we're all evil in some way.
But I'm saying, like, you know, like even in movies, I'm thinking like a movie villain or something, you know, you're like, oh, this is the bad guy. Bad guy does not think he's the bad guy.
I like that. Yeah,
yeah, that's definitely true.
Well, which is, I guess, what I mean is that just evil doesn't mean anything because everyone thinks they're doing the best they can do.
I think that evil and like good are still important terms, but I think we make the mistake of applying them too often to individual people. But I think that ideas can certainly be evil.
Exactly. Okay.
And that's why people went to war against Germany in the first place, was against the idea, which everyone's in agreement is evil, but what led to the production of that weren't necessarily evil people. There were people that were put into situations that were beyond their control in a lot of regards.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the interesting thing to me about that is we're often trained to think about things in binaries, mm-hmm. right?
Well, not good. Even beside training, I think that almost human nature and instinct is to group things and categorize to the most basic level.
You gotta go fast. Right. Mm-hmm. You gotta be cognitively efficient.
Right.
Right. Like don't get eaten by a tiger, you know?
Yeah, it's like there are all kinds of examples of our genetics having developed so that we can make these quick decisions mm-hmm. so that we are safe and not eaten. but the thing is, like... And I want to make it clear that we're in no way trying to rationalize or sort of give an excuse for the actions of Hitler's or the people who served in the German army and perpetrated these
not a Holocaust
crimes.
Apology session.
And we got to remember that this is we're still looking at this in the context of as a healer.
Right.
Yes.
Ultimately.
Yeah. And all we know at this point about Mr. W is he's given us a little bit of his personal history, which can seem understandable given the circumstances as explained to us. But Dr. Sussman goes on to say, I tried to collect my thoughts. Mr. W. broke with silence and, you know, said after 1938, he was, you know, sent to the Eastern Front, which, you know, then led to him being a prisoner of war. And he says here, he increasingly became defensive with an edge of defiance. He reported that his past had been thoroughly vetted during the immigration process, and he had nothing to hide. As we talked, Mr. W. grew angry. 45 years after World War II, he acknowledged some German mistakes, but spoke of other nations' war crimes as well. What Germany had done was no different. He felt no remorse. He had done what anyone else in his circumstance would have.
So did he share that unprompted? Because
no, Dr. Sussman kind of pressed him to share his background.
And to share his thoughts on the war and his beliefs?
I think that kind of just blew out. Yeah, it sounds like that
might have been part of it. Did start to doesn't just, it seem like buried guilt kind of thing?
Yeah, he kind of just started word vomiting it.
I mean, my guess is that this has happened to him before. Right. He says he gets along with all his Jewish doctors.
Hasn't he been going from Jewish doctor to Jewish doctor?
Yeah, and why else would you come in with presents? You want to ingratiate them to you so that when they find out you were a Nazi, they don't kick you to the curb again.
Yeah, and that's
clearly happened before.
That's actually something that I want to explore a little bit later as Dr. Sussman sort of gets into how he reacts to this situation. But one thing that jumps out at me in this is that he has ready explanations for and you know, he's making sure it's like, no, you don't need to send me to Nuremberg for the trial. Like, you know, I've been vetted. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't kill anyone, you know. But it's the idea that other people have done things that are war crimes as well. So Germany is no different. We've just heard this rhetorical thing occur in our own political discourse just recently.
I mean, he's not wrong. Genocides committed on, like, people of color, for example, or in the Middle East that are, like, awful, arguably worse civil wars than the Holocaust, for example, we just don't hear about as much.
Right. And I think a lot of that might have to do with the fact that the Holocaust was one of the first genocides where everything was visible.
That's true. You know? And everybody kind of got involved. A lot of them are a lot more localized and, like, not all these countries get involved.
Right.
Well, it was also, like, really the first time that the power of, like, the Industrial Revolution was put towards, like, systematic extermination.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was, like, once we had all the science and factories and technology and, like, all of that stuff that brought all its benefits was also kind of turned against humanity in regard to, I think.
Yeah.
Right. Right. I mean, the whole idea that the human being had developed to the point where they were on the precipice of controlling the smallest elements of existence. We were down to that level of conflict, right? So I think you could argue that the best and the worst of humanity was on display during World War II.
Yeah.
And often, you know, it's how things played out that made the biggest difference.
Right.
But yeah, he's, Mr. W has now come out and laid these things out that are pretty shocking. And I wonder what an analog would be for, you know, the United States. I think if you were to meet, say, a Confederate soldier and have a discussion with a Confederate soldier in the years after the Civil War, there would be gray areas that still would not be agreed upon, I suppose. Mm. Let's say. And so now we can start to talk about Dr. Sussman's reaction. He says, I felt driven to confront him, not with argument, but with exposure. I wanted to know why. I think it was less what I said and how I listened and looked. He reacted as if he were in retreat when suddenly he attacked. The Jews were responsible for everything that happened to them. The Jews had grown rich while native Germans suffered. The Jews had victimized Germans, exploited them. The Jews got what they deserved. And then he denies the 6 million dead. And
it was pretty hypocritical of him at this point.
Yeah.
to absolve himself of any responsibility, yet assign it to them essentially in the same breath.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a defense mechanism. A terrible one that we should try to avoid, but I mean, that's what it is.
Well,
displacing all the blame, rationalizing.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that's wrong with the way that he is thinking about this.
But it's a very human way to think about it, whether we want to admit it or not.
Yeah, and it's self-protective.
Yeah.
You know, to not have a ready rationalization for that would mean that you would have to take some responsibility for it.
And who do you guys want to take responsibility for the deaths of 6 million people and like feel that guilt? Because like, I don't think I would.
I would
want
argue
to.
You can't even.
like where would you even start? Yeah.
So here we are, pretty much back to where we were with Article One, right? We've got this very complexly unrepentant person who, it's now very personal. Like, your heritage, your lineage are all tied up in this problem between you and this patient. And I'd never, okay, so I'm not a physician. I had never really considered the possibility of like physicians firing patients.
Right? Yeah, it's a thing.
Right.
So Dr. Sussman is at this point. What is his reaction? How does he do this? And what's the ultimate outcome?
Well, ultimately, he decides that he just can't treat this patient and provide the highest quality medical care the standard he holds himself to. But I think that this article combined with the last one too, I think the two help form the real spectrum we're looking at, where the first piece was very much on, we have these biases and they force us essentially to give lower quality medical care even when we're not prepared. And then this one is saying we're human, you know? I mean, it's the point of this podcast, right? We're
right.
not gods yeah. nor machines.
Exactly.
And that's really the point that this article makes, is that at some point you can't just become completely unbiased.
Yeah.
Right.
You can try to. You can tell yourself you're going to.
Right.
And he kind of does. And then he like realizes like, I am giving this person terrible care.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he describes like prescribing things over the phone.
Yeah. Like, yeah. He's like, well, this guy could have a pulmonary embolism, but...
But
like,
yeah.
He does try, I guess, to maintain it, but it clearly the relationship has suffered.
Yeah.
Far more than sustainable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's doing this and he's trying to take as much responsibility for the subpar care that he feels he's giving as he can. Mm-hmm. You know, he's wrestling very much so with who he is as a person and what his responsibility as a physician is. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, in this case, I think you would have to say, like, the physician loses this battle.
And he feels bad about it.
Right. I mean, he even describes Mr. W as, one of his infrequent, detestable patients. Right.
Yeah. And I mean IDPs.
Yes. You know, and it's not just like the annoying drug seeker or, you know, something that does happen quite a bit and is a hazard of being a physician in certain contexts. Like, this is a guy that on like a basic human level, I think this man detests, and he doesn't know how to deal with that. So he deals with it poorly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he's doing the same thing Mr. W did, and that he's rationalizing his poor care by telling or saying that this is a infrequent, detestable person, you know, and explaining away because he can't really take the guilt that he is unable to provide for this person.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You know, I think this helps us form kind of more of a useful definition too for treating the person and what that really means is, I think that a big part of it now as I'm thinking about this piece is acknowledging that you too are a person, and really what that's getting at is that you have a shared humanity between you two.
Right.
And that I think that this takes it so far that, I mean, we like in clinic, people often will have biases against people who are smokers or are overweight.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just not realistic to say, oh, you know, I can't treat them because I have a little bit of a bias. So medicine expects you to be able to temper your biases as much as you can. But once it becomes so personal that you are a Jewish doctor that has like been raised around World War II and been named after your uncle who died or whatever they were saying,
right, yeah.
And you're treated with a non-sympathetic, or you're treated with a non-sympathetic Nazi, there's still a point at which you have to recognize that you're a human too, and yeah. that it would be better for you to not engage patient. In that point. So there is a limit,
yeah.
right? Right.
Better for everyone involved.
Right. Yeah, and I think you make a good point that the idea that to be human is to admit your potential weaknesses, right? And so to be a physician is to recognize your humanity and then be able to hopefully temper with your knowledge the fallibility of the human aspect of who you are, your own personhood, yeah. right? I mean, you bring up the good example of, you know, whether it's an obese patient or a smoker or I read another one of these articles in a different year where a physician struggled with the idea that he had quote unquote good patients who were facing life altering or you know basically life ending mm-hmm. conditions who died, and yet then he also had these quote unquote bad patients who were alcoholics or whatever, and they recovered and survived and went on mm-hmm. and you know he struggled with how to rectify his feelings about those two things. Mm. What he didn't recognize in that was that the alcoholic patient is not the binary bad, right? The alcoholic patient has an entire narrative that goes all the way back and is like has comorbidities with so many different things, nature, nurture, mm-hmm. experience, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That brought that person to that point. So to only use the binary of good and bad
right.
does the disservice of not recognizing personhood.
Yeah.
Metacognition. Yay.
and to me, that's something that one thing I try and teach whenever I'm working with med students or anybody really is the idea that like, as a physician, at any given moment, whatever situation you're in with a patient, you are in that moment the steward of that patient's story. That means that you both have to comprehend that story and feel empathy for that story, but then be able to pass it on to the next person who's going to provide care. And so that includes trying to give some sense of who that person is.
So this is extra true in, I think, psychiatry. I could give some examples. Like, we had a patient that I treated for, like, a whole week. He was my patient on inpatient psych. And, like, you know, towards the end of the thing, we found out that he had, like, domestic abuse charges. And I've also done work with domestic violence. And, you know, so, like, obviously I'm like, no, don't be domestic violence bad. No bad. You know, but, like... Here was this person that I'd been like hanging out with. I mean, not really hanging out, but you know, like we clicked, we got along. It was cool. And you know, so like how do you rectify that in your mind, I guess? And I think that's never going to stop. If I do psych, I need to enter it prepared to be as minimally judgmental as possible, because everyone has these complex pasts and everyone has good and bad things about them. And in psych especially, I think you're going to see some of the worst things. You're going to see sex offenders. You're going to see people who have committed violent crimes. You're going to see people who have perpetrated domestic violence or sexual assault. Like, you're going to see those people. Are you going to use your interaction with them to help make them make better choices? Or are you going to dismiss them? Or, like, I don't know. Like,
or
like,
are you going to treat them as the disease?
Or are you
going to
treat
the
them regardless?
Mm-hmm. Right?
Hurt people, hurt people.
Hurt people, hurt people.
And yeah. If you're, you know, in the fight to defend hurt people by, you know, from other hurt people.
Yeah. It's hard, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. Like,
it hurts.
Yeah. So anyway.
I always count on Mark to really bring it home. Well, but that's the thing. That brings us straight back around to that original Osler quote. You know, do you treat the disease or the patient with the disease?
Yeah.
I think what you're saying there is that you have to find a way, even in these really difficult situations, especially in like mental health areas,
yeah.
To find a way to identify maybe with the patient,
yeah,
and recognize the very gray area where the patient and the disease coexist.
You are more than the sum of the bad things that you have done.
Right, right, and I as a foster parent. I see this stuff, you know, in action in the real world, where people aren't yet receiving the care that they need, and things are going very wrong. And I think ultimately, when you put yourself in the position to deal with people and to try and help people and to serve them in the best way you possibly can, whatever your situation, it becomes really difficult to deal in binaries.
Well, that's why the humanities are so great.
Exactly.
They're about everything non-binary. And also, having thought about this stuff before you go into a situation helps. Like, I'm not going to lie. I was on internal medicine in clinics, in inpatient, the day after the election. I had to drag my sad ass into clinics into the units and see my patients. And I'm not going to lie. It was pretty hard when I walked in a room and Fox News was blaring. But having thought about it before helped a lot to just tune out, to sort of shut off that part of my brain for the time being. Now, I still don't know if, like, what's his name? Bannon. If Steve Bannon walked into my office, I might have to send him to another provider.
What if
he
brought a bunch of gifts?
No. I can't accept
them. And invited
them.
You to Bavaria.
We don't do that anymore.
Yeah. Okay, so that was a reference to an invitation that Mr. W. Yeah,
sorry.
Extended to. It wasn't just Mark being random. It was from the previous reading. Right.
Sure it was.
But I think you make a great point, Casey. And that might be a good place to kind of start to wrap up this idea that, you know, what's the old saying? Pre-something is pre-something. I'm not wrapping this up all that well.
That was going right there.
No, let's end it there.
Yeah.
I'm going to print that on a canvas.
Yeah, it's like,
let's make t-shirts.
T-shirts from that. No, but this idea that if you prepare in the right way, then you will be prepared for things that I think everyone acknowledges that the medical curriculum doesn't always provide all of the instruction necessary to be a complete physician. Some things you have to learn in other ways, whether by experience or extending yourself.
I think an interesting caveat to this discussion too is that not treating the patient or not treating the disease and treating the patient with the disease means different things now to different types of physicians.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
How would a pathologist interpret that, really?
I don't think they care.
I think that's why they're pathologists.
But it's funny because they're still a physician, really.
Yeah, it's true.
And they still go through the same training, and in a lot of ways, in the eyes of society, are looked upon very similarly.
Yeah.
I think that I don't really know where to go with that, but I think
it's a good point. I mean, you know, sometimes maybe there is a best shelf for you to put yourself on,
right?
You know, and you have
I
to
think always,
but you also have to be able to be self aware enough and to explore these things in your own way, in order to make those decisions.
Yeah. Right. And know that there's different degrees of other people too. So like, just a random person that I disagree with politically, even if I disagree strongly with them, is different than someone who's out there like actively hurt, like, I don't know, like actively attacking a group that I identify with.
Right.
Like the Jewish physician, for example, right. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, well, there's a spectrum and a lot of them with this pre-preparation, you can deal with it a lot better, especially if you really believe that healthcare is a right for everyone and you want to be part of providing that. You want to practice shutting that part of yourself off.
Or at least, I'm always reluctant to say things like shutting that part of myself off.
Same.
Well, I mean,
but to
regulating it, the sort of judgmental part. I try to shut that off as much as I can in daily life.
There's like an acceptance and an acknowledgement.
Yeah.
That's a healthier way to say it. We're talking about the exact same thing.
Yeah. Not denial. I don't want to be in denial about it.
Right.
Because if you deny your biases, they just get worse.
Right.
As was brought forth in Mr. W's actions.
Mr. W.
So,
thank you.
I have no idea how long this has gone.
I don't know what just happened.
But you know, I think
we'll explain when you're older.
I think this has been a really good conversation. It's one of those conversations where, like, you explore potential answers. It's sort of like multiple choice, but not.
It was very philosophical.
Yeah.
You are really giving some like great closing lines here. Yeah.
I know.
You're going to pick, he's going to edit and just combine it all into one sentence.
Yeah. Be the ball.
What?
I don't know. I'm just
Did I miss something?
I'm just trying to come up with like any sort of vague philosophical thing that I can
live,
possibly
live, laugh,
come.
Love.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I hate it.
Yeah.
Philosophical phrase generator.
Yeah. I'm sure I want to call that there. Philosophical.
Yeah. Maybe that's what I need to get that up on my iPad before the end of each show and
probably
just
find like a philosophy bot.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm sure there is.
All right. But I'm going to end it now. It's going to end now.
That's a good
I'd like to thank all of you for being here. That being Casey, Adam, Mark, Kelsey. Thank you guys for having this conversation. I really enjoyed it. And so this will be up and hopefully people will be able to read and then join in the discussion in comments or emails or whatever way we are able to receive communications in this digital age. My name's Jason T. Lewis. I'm the director of the Writing Humanities here at program at the Carver College of Medicine. I've been talking for a long time. Until next week, this has been episode 4 of Not Gods and Machines. Thanks so much for being here, and I hope you will come back again soon.